This week's morning stories are told by Anthony Bilbell, and here he is with the first one, which is called Worthington DIY, which means, as you probably know, do it yourself.
Hello. It's nice to be back, and I hope you'll join me every morning this week. I put one foot on my three-legged stool, leant forward and held my guitar firmly but lightly under my arm. The curved bit was resting comfortably on my bent leg. "Right, Worthington," I said. "Now what shall it be?" He curled back his top lip and made hissing noises through his teeth. His tail drooped. Ignoring him, I struck a chord with my right hand. The sound bounced round the walls of my living room, and Worthington howled, like a wolf at bay. "I know, yes, yes, I know," I said. "I got the fingering wrong. And do you know why? Because you're putting me off. You make me nervous, groaning and grumbling all the time." Worthington bedded his head under his front paws and whined. It was one of those piercing sounds that make your eardrums tingle. "Oh, for heaven's sake," I said. "Look, do you suppose the great Segovia's dog made such a fuss when he was learning to play the guitar? I shall ignore you." And I did, while I concentrated on the fingering of the left hand. Very tricky stuff. It was back in the spring that I bought the guitar and a book on how to play it. What the book didn't tell me was how to cope with lack of encouragement at home. For the past 8 weeks, I'd been in a state of constant feuding with Worthington. He's got no ear for music, that's his trouble. Though, as I'd pointed out to him more than once, he didn't have to stay in the same room when I was practicing. I struck another chord. Worthington got to his feet and came round to where he could stand looking straight at me. Then he gave a short bark. "Yes," I said. "You wanted to say something? Some critical comment, perhaps? Something clever about diminished ninths, whatever they are?" But sarcasm is wasted on Worthington. He just went on standing there, gazing at me. So I tried again, and a string broke with a ping. The one farthest away from you looking down, that one. I think it's the E string. Worthington snorted. I could have sworn he was laughing. Then he turned his back on me. His ears were twitching. "Well," I said, "that's that. No more guitar practice tonight, and I hope you're pleased. But make the most of it, because I'm going out tomorrow morning early to buy another string, and I shall get a spare while I'm about it. And by the way, you aren't coming." He turned his head to look at me, then walked out of the room in the direction of the kitchen. His back view looked smug. He's got a very expressive back. I heard him in the kitchen kicking his earthenware bowl about, but he was only putting it on. Next morning he made such a fuss about being left behind that I weakened and took him with me. As a matter of fact, I intended to give way all along. Our destination was a big department store in the High Street. It's one of those interesting shops that sell everything, and we often spend Saturday morning there browsing about. All the assistants know Worthington by sight, if not by name. We took the lift to the third floor. Radios, television sets, record players, musical instruments, and in the opposite direction, gardening implements and do-it-yourself section. I went straight to the musical instruments and bought a couple of E strings, and for good measure, one of those bits of plastic for striking chords. Worthington eyed it with deep suspicion, and I pretended it was for cleaning my nails, but I don't think he was taken in. I went back to the lift and was about to press the bell when I realized that Worthington wasn't with me. I could just see his tail disappearing past a display of lawnmowers, so not wanting to lose sight of him in such a big store, I followed. By the time I caught up with him, he'd reached the do-it-yourself department and was looking about in an interested way. At about the same moment, we both saw and were attracted to a man who'd got a small crowd round him, watching him demonstrate something. I'm always fascinated by demonstration. Worthington usually finds them rather boring. Not this time, though. He joined the group of people even before I did. "Now, gentlemen," the man was saying, "I want you to look closely. I have here the biggest revolution in the erection of sheds, greenhouses, and garden shelters since the invention of the hammer. A child could put up one of our sheds in a couple of hours, so long as it was old enough to read the directions on this very simple plan, which is supplied with each and every do-it-yourself kit. No nuts, no bolts, no hammers, no nails, no screws. In fact, nothing extra is needed but your own two hands and a modicum of common sense. Every piece just slots into the next, with perhaps the merest touch with a wooden mallet to make sure that it's gone right home. And within a couple of hours of delivery, you'll have the smartest looking shed or summer house in your district. Well, I must say that when he showed us how the pieces fitted together, it all looked very easy. But then they always do, don't they? I once bought one of those boomerang things after seeing it demonstrated in a toy shop and smashed 3 wine glasses, 2 coffee cups, an ashtray and a shaving mirror before I admitted defeat. Well now, gentlemen, the demonstrator said, I'm sure you'll agree with me that nothing could be simpler than that. As you see, I have behind me an assortment from our range, all of which I have assembled myself in spare moments. Now, will any gentleman come up here and let me show him how strong they are? Oh, come along, gentlemen. Don't be shy. Nobody moved at first. And then our ranks parted, and who should leap up onto the platform but Worthington, tail wagging, eyes shining. Well. So you'd like to have a look round, would you, sir? Obviously a dog of great intelligence, one who knows a good thing when he sees it. And which particular model are you interested in? Worthington wagged his tail harder than ever, and then without hesitation made straight for an object that looked rather like a house for an Elizabethan midget. It was about 5 feet high, 4 foot long, and about 3 feet wide. The front was white with imitation oak beams in Tudor style. It had a swing door with a porch, and over the porch were carved the words, Ye Doggy, spelt D-O-G-G-E. Oh, and on one side, there was a stained glass window. It was, not to put too fine a point on it, about the most hideous-looking king-sized dog kennel I'd ever seen. But Worthington seemed to love it. He went right inside, and all that could be seen of him was the tip of his tail waving to and fro. There you are, gentlemen, an unsolicited testimonial, said the demonstrator. Now, if the owner of this highly intelligent dog, this dog of taste and discrimination, will kindly step forward. Oh, it's you, sir. Now, if I can have your name and address, I'll tell you when you can expect delivery of our special offer, Do-It-Yourself Superior Dog Kennel. Oh, but I'm afraid I don't... Ah, now, sir, you can't disappoint your dog now. He's completely at home in it already. It'd be sheer cruelty to animals to say no. Has he got a kennel? Well, no, actually, he hasn't. Well, then. The demonstrator and the other members of his audience were looking at me as if I were a sort of Genghis Khan and Attila the Hun rolled into one. Then Worthington came over to me and licked my hand. Oh, well, I gave in and ordered and paid for a special do-it-myself superior dog kennel kit, knowing all the time that I was going to have the greatest trouble in putting it up. I'm the original botcher. I can't even bang a nail into the wall without bringing down half the plaster. Delivery was promised for the following Saturday. The first hurdle to be overcome was the fact that I haven't got a garden of my own. Not entirely, that is. The house in which I have my flat has a large garden used by all the tenants. We each have a bit that is theoretically ours, but as I don't have much time for gardening, I let Miss Lorimer, who lives in the basement flat, grow what she likes in mine. Miss Lorimer owns an elderly cat called Septimus, who's a great friend of Worthington's, and she said that she'd be delighted to have a dog kennel in our bit of the garden because it would be nice for Septimus to have somewhere to sit when it came on to rain suddenly. I thanked her, though actually I'd been hoping that she'd say no, and then I'd have a cast-iron excuse for sending the thing back. I knew that when it was up, my friends would inevitably refer to it as Bilbo's Folly, and who could blame them? The kennel was delivered in 2 cardboard boxes. I took both of them into the garden and spread everything out on the grass. Then I took out the plan that came with them and laid that on the grass too. I studied it from every angle. Then I turned to Webbington and said, "Now you're sure you want to go through with this? There's still time to send it back, you know." He barked and picked up an oldie-worldy oak beam made of plastic between his teeth. All right," I said. "I can take a hint." And I bent over the plan again. Now, let's see. It says there are four walls. Wall A, wall B, wall C, and wall D. Worthington dropped something by my hand. "That," I said, "is not a wall, Worthington." He nudged my leg and held the object out to me between his teeth. I pretended to refer to the blueprint. "Perhaps it's part of the library, Worthington, or the support for the staircase in the west wing." I could see from his expression that he wasn't amused. He doesn't like people to make fun of him, so I relented and tweaked his left ear. "Oh, come on," I said. "Let's leave it for today. All the stuff will be safe enough out here. We'll take the plan indoors, and I'll have a good look at it after we've got a meal inside us." Well, I did honestly intend to get down to it, but after we'd had our dinner and I'd had an hour's guitar practice, I felt so tired I went straight to bed. It was sometime in the early hours of the morning that I awoke with a great weight on my chest. It was Worthington. I pushed him off and fumbled in the dark for the switch on my bedside light. "Oh, Worthington, what's the matter anyway?" "Worthington, it's 5:30 in the morning. Oh, go back to bed. There's a good dog." I turned over and pulled the sheet over my head. Through a veil of sleep, I could feel something sliding across my feet. Then I woke up again because I was cold. Worthington had pulled the blankets off the bed. He just sat there, looking at me. "Oh, no," I said. "Can't it wait till after breakfast?" But once Worthington makes up his mind, he really makes it up. By 6 o'clock, I was out in the garden, hard at work, putting up his do-it-yourself superior dog kennel. The man in the shop had said that it could be erected by a child in a couple of hours. It took me 2 days, with interruptions for meals and sleep. But when it was done, I straightened my back and looked at the thing with a craftsman's pride mingled with loathing. "Well, there it is, Worthington. It's all yours. It may have the odd nail or two in it, but only for added support, and they'll come in useful for hanging things on. And that slight lean to the left gives it a sort of picturesque quality, wouldn't you say?" He circled it 3 times, having a good sniff. Then he went inside and turned round and round as if trying it for size. "Right," I said. "I'll leave you to make yourself at home. I'll go and clean myself up." I had a wash, changed, and made myself a big plate of bacon and eggs. It was the first decent meal I'd had time for since I started work on Worthington's kennel. Well, I've earned a rest, I thought to myself. I'll have half an hour on the guitar, and then I'll put my feet up with a book. But when I came to look for my guitar, I couldn't find it anywhere. And they're big things to lose. I searched high and low, even trying the broom cupboard in the back of the wardrobe. I went back into the living room and looked for it a second time in the place where I usually keep it. While I was standing in the middle of the carpet looking round me, Worthington pushed the door open with his nose, crossed the room, climbed into his chair, curled himself up, and fell fast asleep. "Oi, you've got your own house now," I said, and I prodded him with one finger. He opened his eyes, yawned, and shut them again. And that was when my eyes were opened. Well, I had to give up the guitar after that. I mean, finding it where Worthington had put it, on the floor of his dog kennel, was the sort of broad hint you can't go on ignoring. I think he meant it kindly enough in his own way. He just wouldn't understand that I'd be too proud to go and sit in a dog kennel, even a superior dog kennel, to practice my chords. The kennel's still there, of course. I can't spare another 2 days to pull it down. And I was right about my friends. They do call it Bilbo's Folly. It's nothing to what I call it, I can tell you. Still, Septimus the Cat likes it.
That story, Worthington DIY, was told by Anthony Bilbo and written by Marjorie and Anthony Bilbo. Tomorrow, their morning story is called The Man in Trafalgar Square. 11 o'clock. The Man in Trafalgar Square. Today's morning story comes from Anthony Bilbo.
The man in Trafalgar Square thought that it was one of those days that makes everything look shabby. He shivered slightly as he looked at the overcast sky and at the starlings whirling round and round. He turned up the collar of his raincoat. It was off-white and belted, in a style that had been quite the latest thing 7 years ago when he'd bought it. Now it was grubby and frayed at the cuffs. And in it, he looked like an unsuccessful confidence trickster. His face was thin and pale, and there were red marks on his chin where he cut himself shaving. His eyes, as he squinted up at the figure of Nelson almost directly above him, seemed smaller and closer together than they really were. He carried a small imitation leather suitcase. Among the crowds of people standing about, he was noticeable only for an air of indecision, almost of shiftiness. The man in Trafalgar Square stopped looking at the figure of Nelson and turned his attention on the families with children, the courting couples, the groups of tourists taking pictures of each other. They all seemed to be with someone. And then he caught sight of a girl sitting by herself on a bench, reading a book. Pretending to be lost in thought, he walked over and sat down beside her. Funny sort of weather for August, isn't it? He said. The girl didn't answer. She edged away a few inches and moved her handbag from beside her onto her lap. Do you work round here? Said the man. It must be a nice place to come in your lunch hour, and if it rains, you can always pop into the National Gallery. Now look here, said the girl, if you're trying to pick me up, you're wasting your time. If you don't go away, I'll call a policeman. No, miss, you've got it all wrong. I only wanted to pass the time of day. Oh, all right, I'll go. The man in Trafalgar Square stood up and walked hurriedly away to the far side of the fountain. Once there, he stopped and looked around, wondering whether anybody had noticed his exchange with the girl. But no one had time to waste looking at an insignificant little man in an off-white, unfashionable raincoat. Reassured, he went over to another seat, on which was a man wearing a bowler hat and a dark overcoat, and adding up a column of figures in a notebook. Funny sort of day for August, isn't it? Thought it was going to be quite nice when I started out. It's, my day off, you see.
Oh? Really?
Yes, my day off. First time I've been up to town for, must be 3 years now. No, I tell a lie. I was here just over 6 months ago, but that was on a bit of private business. At the, law courts, you know. The other man reversed his pencil and used a rubber at the other end of it to erase some figures he'd just written.
Oh, yes, he said.
Yes, private business. But as I say, it's been all of 3 years since I was last in Trafalgar Square. Yet, in a way, I ought to come here more often. It belongs to me, you see. Do you know why?
I've really no idea.
Well, it's my bit of fun, really, but, you see, my name's Nelson. Nelson, you see? What do you think of that?
Remarkable.
And what's more, my first name's Horace. You see? Horace, Horatio, get it? Of course, I used to get my leg pulled at school, but parents never seem to think of that, do they? Still, since I've been grown up, I've come along when I could to pay my respects to his nibs up there. But not during the last 3 years, you see. Because it was 3 years ago that, look, do you mind? I'm trying to concentrate. That's the second time I've added up that column wrongly.
Oh, sorry.
Horace Nelson sat in silence. Then he unfastened the catches of his imitation leather suitcase and took out a brown paper bag containing a couple of sandwiches. He looked at them, glanced across at the other man and said,
fancy a sandwich?
No, thank you.
I don't think I will either.
Horace Nelson tore the sandwich into small bits and scattered them in front of him. Within moments, the seat was surrounded by pigeons and sparrows, fluttering their wings and squawking. The other man muttered something, shut his notebook, got to his feet and hurried away. Horace Nelson waited until the birds had eaten both of his sandwiches, then he too rose and walked away in the direction of the Strand. He strolled along, looking in all the shops, and once he went into a cafe for a cup of tea. When he was halfway along Fleet Street, it came on to rain. Oh, well, this is a dead loss. Might as well go home, he thought. On the bus, he held up sixpence. Charing Cross Station, please. The conductor took the money and gave him a ticket. No strikes today, then, I see, said Horace Nelson. The conductor looked at him without interest. Strikes? What strikes?
Oh, nothing, just a little joke, that's all.
Oh, so we've got a funny man on board, have we? You ought to be on the telly. Horace Nelson got off the bus two stops before he needed to and walked the rest of the way to Charing Cross in the rain. His raincoat let water in, so once he was under cover of the station, he took it off and put it over his arm. There was a train on his line due in 6.5 minutes, so he went straight to the barrier and offered his return half to the collector, who punched it and motioned him by without looking at him. The train was quite full, and Horace Nelson had to walk nearly to the front before he could find a seat. The compartment held three other passengers, two men and a woman.
Room for a little one, he said.
All three looked up, but no one spoke. He slammed the door behind him and sat down in the nearest corner. The woman was opposite him. The two men occupied the other two corners, furthest from the corridor.
Well, 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 cold enough for you? He said to the compartment at large.
One of the men smiled slightly in acknowledgement and then disappeared behind his newspaper. The woman glanced across at him and looked away quickly. Horace guessed what she was thinking. That nasty, shifty-eyed little man is trying to get off with me. Thank goodness I'm not alone in here. Horace bent down and put his suitcase on the floor at his feet. Looking at it, it seemed to him that it had suddenly become transparent, that everyone could see what it contained. An apple, a paperback thriller, and three letters from his wife. Goodness only knew why he still carried them around. The oldest letter was just about 3 years old, the newest 11 months. Make a clean sweep, that's what anyone sensible would do. He'd take them out, and then when he reached his station, he would tear them up and throw them into the litter bin. He picked up the suitcase again, opened it, and took out the letters. He tore each of them in half and pushed the pieces into his raincoat pocket. That was that. He turned to the man sitting on his right.
Going far, are you?
Sorry, what did you say?
Going far, got far to go?
No, not far. The man turned slightly so that he was facing out of the window. Horace Nelson gave up. It was no use. People just didn't want to talk to him. The second man, the one who'd smiled, was hiding behind his newspaper. The woman kept darting little glances at him. Clearly, she would pull the communication cord if he so much as offered to close the window for her. She was about 30, or just a little older, and a bit on the skinny side. Not like his wife Valerie, or his ex-wife Valerie, he must remember to think of her. Valerie was shorter, but plump. Very good looking, even now, and a wife any man could be proud of having, except that she wasn't his wife any longer. 3 years ago, she'd left him, after 4 years of marriage. Well, you could hardly blame her. She'd thought she was marrying a real live wire, a go-ahead sort of chap who would soon be at the top of the tree. The way he'd dressed in those days had something to do with it. She didn't know that he'd bought his raincoat in the sale. Horace wasn't the sort to get to the top of even the smallest tree. Clerking in a small office in South London, with annual increments that bore no relationship to the rising cost of living, didn't buy Valerie the sort of home she wanted. It didn't buy her the sort of life she wanted either. And one day she just gave up pretending that there was anything left between them, and when he got back from the office that evening, there'd been a letter lying on the kitchen table. Just a bald statement of fact that she'd left him for good. His own good. She hoped he'd soon find someone else. Fat chance of that. He wasn't the type. With a start, he suddenly realized that he'd reached his station. With nothing to rush home for, he still had a compulsion to hurry. He threw open the door and jumped out. He joined the queue of people at the barrier, handing in their tickets. Well, that's that, he thought. A fine day out that proved to be, I must say. Waste of time and money. A short bus ride and he was outside the 11-story block of flats built by the council 4 years before to rehouse people from the prefabs they'd pulled down. The flats were very nice, very modern, with big windows, and of course no open fires. He'd hoped Barry would be more contented when they moved in, but in a funny sort of way, it had seemed to hasten her departure. Living in the prefab, she'd always had someone to talk to, but she got lonely in the flat by herself all day. And although the rent had been quite reasonable, his wages didn't run to the sort of furniture she'd wanted to buy to match their new modern home. She took a job, saved some money, and went. She'd written to him 3 times since then, once asking him to send on her clothes to her aunt in Huddersfield, but the letter was postmarked London, so he knew she was only using her aunt as a sort of clearinghouse. The second letter enclosed the key of the flat and said she hoped by now he realized she'd done the right thing. The third had asked him to divorce her. And last week, he'd received the official notification that he was a single man again. Horace Nelson's flat was right at the top. He went up in the lift and walked down the corridor to his door. As he opened it, he caught sight of Mrs. Hopkins across the landing putting out 2 milk bottles. He didn't bother to say hello because he knew that she didn't like him. She'd been a friend of Valerie's, and she blamed the breakup of their marriage on him. Well, she was right in a way, but you couldn't help the way you were made. Some people were born to make a success of their lives, and others weren't. The flat seemed cold and unwelcoming when he went in. He would have liked to keep a cat or a dog for company, but it was against the rules. He had a goldfish, but however much he tried, he couldn't kid himself that he cared for him in the least, or noticed when he came or went. He put on the kettle and made himself a pot of tea. Then he opened a tin of spaghetti and heated it up in a saucepan. It was just beginning to bubble when the doorbell rang. He jumped. The sound was such an unusual one in his life. It was the woman he'd seen on the train. She was holding a raincoat, an off-white raincoat, his raincoat. Mr. Nelson? Yes, I was, the train, said the woman. I saw you go, but I didn't notice your raincoat till it was too late. I got off at the next station. I live there, you see. Well, not there exactly, Wendlewood Road. Oh, yes, I know it. So you brought it back? There were some torn letters with your... Oh, yes, yes, that's right, there were. Thanks. Well, I'll be getting along then, said the woman. Oh, must you? Said Horace. I mean, wouldn't you like to come in for a cup of tea? Least I can do. I've just made some. Oh, are you sure, Mr. Nelson? Oh, well, just one cup then, thank you. Getting out a second cup and saucer was a moment of excitement for Horace. It seemed to wake him up, and he said, Funny, you living so near. I mean, Wendlewood Road. I used to know some people down there. Name of Summers. You don't know them? No, I'm afraid I don't, but then I don't make friends easily. Don't you? Oh, well, neither do I, said Horace. Oh, I'm sure you do, Mr. Nelson. I really admired you on the train today. Admired me? Me? Well, of course, I'd never have the nerve to speak to perfect strangers, but you did it so nicely. Wish I could do that. In fact, I was only sorry you didn't speak to me. You were sorry, but I thought... What did you think, Mr. Nelson? Oh, nothing. But Horace was smiling now. His day out might not have been such a waste of time after all, he thought. At last, he had someone to talk to.
The Man in Trafalgar Square was told by Anthony Bilbo and was written, as are all this week's morning stories, by Marjorie and Anthony Bilbo. Tomorrow's story is called The Birthday Card, and fans of Worthington can look forward to hearing about him on Friday morning again. It's 11 o'clock, and time for another morning story with Anthony Bilbo. It's called The Birthday Card.
Brenda Truman hummed to herself as she finished the washing up. Only 9:30, and she'd already broken the back of the housework. It was one of those mornings when everything seemed to go right, which was surprising, really, because she'd gone to bed quite late the night before, and she knew from experience that a late night usually meant burnt toast and lumpy porridge the next morning. Even the children had been extra good and hadn't kept Elsie Winton hanging about when she and her little girl had called for them. Brenda Truman and Elsie Winton took it in turns to take their children to school. The system worked quite well, except that Elsie's daughter was always ready on time, and Brenda's twins seldom were. Brenda paused for a moment so that the clatter of the plates shouldn't make her miss what the housewife's choice man was saying. She loved hearing all the messages and trying to picture what the people were like. What a lot of happy, loving families there must be in the world, she thought. Happy, loving families like her own. Perhaps one day, when the children were grown up, she'd hear an announcer saying, "Now, my next record is for the most wonderful mother in the world, Mrs. Brenda Truman, from her daughter Caroline." Or it might be, "This record comes with love to the most wonderful Nana in the world." Just think, Jimmy and Caroline with babies of their own. Oh well, no time for daydreaming, or she'd soon lose the benefit of the good start to the day. A quick dust round in the living room, and with any luck, she could be up to the high street before the shops got crowded. Having so many friends drop round last night, celebrating Robert's birthday, had practically emptied her store cupboard of biscuits and cheese and things like that. And while she was about it, it wouldn't be a bad idea to take one of Robert's suits to the cleaners. She took a pride in making sure that he always looked well cared for. Men were so funny about their clothes, pretending they didn't care what they wore, yet just as fussy as women, really. And say what you like, it must help a man making his way in the world. Though Robert would be a success whatever he wore. He was always so friendly and cheerful. Everybody liked him. No wonder he'd had so many birthday cards yesterday, at least 20. Not many people got so many once they were grown up. Brenda opened the door of the living room and looked across at the row of cards on the mantelpiece, and then at the overflow on the sideboard. How gay they looked. What bright colours. It seemed a pity that they couldn't stay there all the year round. There were funny ones and serious ones. Some had pictures of cats, because everybody knew that Robert loved cats, and some had pictures of men smoking pipes. And there was her own card, all by itself on top of the television, where Robert himself had put it. She hadn't bought one with a lot of loving words printed on it. You couldn't use somebody else's words when you wanted to say how much you loved your husband and how happy it made you. It was just a picture of a country cottage. But Robert understood, because it was just like the place where they'd spent their honeymoon 10 years before. If you were happy, truly happy in your marriage, surely you didn't have to make a parade of it in front of other people. It just showed in everything you did. It didn't mean you had to keep telling everybody how happy you were, like Elsie Winton did. Ted Winton had looked quite embarrassed at some of the things she'd said at the party last night. Ted Winton was the man who shared Robert's office. Well, it was the other way around, really, because he was Robert's senior at the firm. He was 5 years older than Robert, almost to the day, and had been with the firm since he left school. The two couples had been on visiting terms for years, but Brenda and Elsie had only started to meet without their husbands after their children started going to the same school. Brenda quite liked Elsie, but she wasn't a friend she would have chosen for herself, not as a real friend. Real friends were people you didn't have to pretend with. People who didn't mind catching you when you just washed your hair. People who didn't look down their noses if you said you couldn't afford something. Besides, Elsie Winton was a bit irritating when she went on and on about how devoted Ted was, and how he always sent her roses on her birthday and on the anniversary of the day they first met. According to Elsie, Ted was always telling her that she was as beautiful as on the day they were married, and he never looked at another woman. Well, that was very nice. Most of the time, Brenda didn't mind Elsie talking about it. What she did mind was the way Elsie always turned the conversation round to Robert and started asking probing questions about him. Did he ever work late at the office? What was his new secretary like? What was her name? Ted had said she was quite pretty, though not his type, of course. Why, even at Robert's own birthday party last night, she'd taken Brenda aside and suggested that she ought to drop in at the office one day, accidentally on purpose. Remember, she said, he's just at the dangerous age, Brenda. Better to be safe than sorry, that's what I always say. Though, of course, Ted never gives me a moment's worry. But could it be that Elsie knew something Brenda didn't? The thought struck Brenda like a blow, making her catch her breath. Suppose Elsie was trying to drop a hint. After all, if Ted told Elsie everything that happened at the office, and she always said that he did, then Elsie would know if Robert were having an affair with his secretary. People in the office always knew about things like that. They just did. Brenda herself had worked in a big office before she was married, and she could remember several affairs that were supposed to be secret, but were actually common knowledge. There was always someone who'd seen the couple holding hands in the lift or having a drink together in some backstreet pub. Everybody knew, but nobody told the wife. That wasn't done. Suppose she did call in at the office. What would happen? The commissionaire at the front door would call on the internal line to say that she was on her way up. And when she reached Robert's office on the sixth floor, he would be at his desk, the very model of a busy young executive. And if his new secretary was as pretty as Ted said, what could Brenda do about it? Just say, "How do you do, Miss Thing? I hope my husband isn't too much of a slave driver." And the girl would say something like, "No, he's very easy to work for." And they would all smile. And then Robert would say, "Look, dear, I don't want to hurry you, but Miss Thing and I have a lot of work to get through this morning. What was it you came in about?" And she would have to pretend that she'd run short of money or something like that. And Robert would know it wasn't the truth, because Brenda always turned red if she told a lie. The telephone bell brought her back to reality. It was Robert himself, calling to ask if she would take his light overcoat to the cleaners. I forgot to mention it before I left, he said, but there's a greasy mark on the sleeve. I didn't notice it till I went to put it on this morning. Oh, thanks. Now, take care when you're crossing the roads, won't you? You know what you're like when your mind's on something else. Brenda promised. And when she put the phone down, she was smiling. Dear Robert, always concerned about her. That was what mattered. Not roses on your birthday and expensive presents. Fancy letting Elsie Winton's stupid chatter affect her so much. Well, now she would have to hurry if she was to get her shopping done before the lunchtime rush started. 10 minutes to get ready, that was all she would allow herself. Just time for a quick wash and makeup and to put on her green suit. 10 minutes later, almost to the second, Brenda was leaving the house with her shopping bag over one arm and Robert's grey suit and his light overcoat over the other. Fortunately, the cleaners was quite near the bus stop, so she could get that job done first. The woman in the cleaners never hurried herself, but she was methodical. Mrs. Truman, 64 Belmont Road, one gent's suit grey and one gent's overcoat. Oh, just a minute. There's something in the pocket. A birthday card. And such a pretty one, too. Don't want that going to the machines, do you, Mrs. Truman? Brenda thanked her and, glancing at the card, dropped it into her shopping bag. The woman was right. It was a pretty card, with some kind of flower on it. One more to add to the display. Oh dear. Suppose the person who sent it had been at the party last night and had looked for it among the others. Oh, dear, people could be awfully touchy about things like that. Outside the shop, she took the birthday card out of her bag and looked at it more closely. The flowers, she realized now, were forget-me-nots, and underneath, printed in deep blue, were the words, "My thoughts are of you." What a funny card to send to a man. Wonder who it's from. She flicked it open. Inside, the printed words said simply, "Happy birthday." But underneath, in a handwriting she didn't recognize, was written, "From your one true love, Scarlett." Who on earth was Scarlett? At first, Brenda was no more than mildly curious. Then it came to her that this was a card from a woman she didn't know, but who obviously knew Robert very well indeed. More important still, it was a card that Robert hadn't shown to her or put on display with the others. Thinking back, she remembered the post arriving just as Robert was leaving for work on the morning of his birthday, and how he'd shuffled through the envelopes before saying, "Oh, these are obviously all cards. I'll look at them all this evening when I've more time." How easy for him to have taken one and slipped it into his pocket. So Elsie Winton had been right. This was what she'd been getting at. Like a machine that once set in motion continues to work no matter what happens, Brenda went about her routine shopping. She consulted a list. She went to the right shops. She said the right things to the assistants who served her. She smiled in the right way at everyone she knew. But all the time, her thoughts were elsewhere. What was she going to do? What was she going to say when Robert came home that evening? She longed for someone to confide in, someone she could turn to for advice. But this wasn't the sort of thing you blurted out to the first acquaintance you bumped into. Perhaps she should talk to Elsie when she brought the children home. Ask her to stop hinting and tell her the truth. But no. The one thing Brenda couldn't bear just now would be Elsie's thinly concealed satisfaction at the failure of somebody else's marriage. Failure? Well, that's a big word to use just because you'd found one birthday card with an affectionate message from a woman in your husband's pocket. What to do? Confront him with having deceived her? Pack the children's clothes in a trunk and leave him for good? Destroy the card and forget all about it? The wisest course. Why force Robert into some kind of decisive action that might end their marriage? But Brenda knew she wasn't the kind to get away with the pretense that nothing had happened. If Robert sensed that something was wrong and questioned her, she might do and say all the wrong things. Better to have it out with him now than wait until she worked herself into a nervous state. But how? Brenda sat for a long time at her kitchen table. Asked, she would have said that she was thinking. In reality, she was imagining life without Robert, taking a job, explaining to Jimmy and Caroline. When the children arrived back from school, she was still sitting there, a full pot of tea standing cold and untouched in front of her. She played with them a little while, gave them their supper, and took them up to bed before it was time for Robert to get home. Then, when she was alone again, she took the birthday card and placed it on the television beside her own. Side by side, the two cards challenged Robert to make a choice. Brenda sat down and waited. Robert got home at his usual time, just after 7.
"Where are you, dear?"
"In the living room," said Brenda. He came in and greeted her with a kiss. "It's not usual to find you sitting down peacefully at this time of day," he said. "Oh, I was admiring all your birthday cards," said Brenda. "Yes, they're a fine lot," said Robert. "Oh, wait a minute, though. You've put another one with yours. I wanted yours by itself." "That one with the forget-me-nots was in the pocket of your overcoat," said Brenda. "Oh, it's that one. I forgot I still had it. But it's not mine." "Isn't it?" said Brenda. "Of course not. That card was sent to old Ted Winton. You know, his birthday's a week before mine. It's from Mrs. O'Hara, who does the cleaning. She's been with the firm donkey's years, and Ted's got a sort of running gag with her. Calls her Scarlett O'Hara. You know, Gone with the Wind. Well, anyway, She left this card on his desk for him to find on his birthday. He was tickled pink. But then Elsie Winton came in, all accidentally on purpose, like she always does. Though what she thinks she's going to find, I don't know. And what do you think? Ted picked that card up and pushed it into my pocket before Elsie could see it. What do you think of that? Robert put his arm round Brenda's shoulders and gave her a squeeze. You know, it's amazing what jealousy and a vivid imagination can do to spoil a marriage, he said. Thank goodness you aren't like that. Don't ever change, will you? I'll try not to, Robert, said Brenda.
That story, The Birthday Card, written by Marjorie and Anthony Bilbo, was told by Anthony Bilbo. It's 11 o'clock and time for another morning story with Anthony Bilbo. This one is called Albert Stirs Things Up.
Hello again. Albert Figg took a red ballpoint pen from his breast pocket and ticked off the items on a sheet of paper torn from a shorthand notebook. Half a pound of best tea, packet of lump sugar, one packet of ordinary sweet biscuits for the staff, one packet of special chocolate biscuits for clients, two doughnuts, and a bar of soap. Yes, they were all there in the wire basket. He always liked to check over his list before reaching the cashier. These service self shops were all really well, but it was a bit embarrassing if you forgot anything and held up everybody in the queue while he went back for it. And these young girls they had operating the cash registers always looked so impatient if you fumbled with your money or looked a bit bewildered. Hurry up, Grandpa, we haven't got all day, you know. That's what that cheeky little madam with the red hair said last Monday when he'd come in for the week's supply of tea and biscuits for the office. But the cheeky little madam wasn't operating the cash register this time. She was standing beside a woman of about 60, who was apparently learning how to use the machine, shaking her head impatiently as the older woman stabbed at the keys as if she expected the cash register to bite her. When the older woman pulled the lever that should have released Albert Figg's receipt, something jammed, and the strip of paper came out looking like a concertina. Oh dear, I am so sorry, sir, she said. Oh, that's all right. Don't worry, said Albert. I know how much it comes to. 6 and 8 pence. Here you are, I've got the right money. The woman gave him a quick smile before turning to the next customer, who was already waiting with wire basket at the ready. The smile took years off her age, and as Albert packed his purchases into the carrier bag he'd brought with him, he thought how hard life was for some people. There was a woman who wasn't at all bad-looking, if she gave herself half a chance, and who ought to be sitting at home with her feet up, listening to the radio. Instead, she was taking orders from a silly little chit of a girl young enough to be a granddaughter. It wasn't right. True, Albert was still working at 76, but it was different with him, quite different. His job had dignity. He was indispensable. At least twice a week, Mr. Elder, the boss, said, I don't know how we managed before you came, Albert. I really don't. Albert took up his carrier bag and left the shop. 50 yards along on the opposite side of the main road was Disley Street. He turned in at the door by the brass plate that read Elder and Company, Registered Offices, First Floor. He climbed the steep flight of wooden stairs that led to the 3 and a bit rooms that housed Mr. Elder, Mr. Elder's secretary, Ursula Green, Miss Jones, the copytypist, whom everybody but Albert called Podge, Mr. Ramsden, the senior clerk, Mr. Victor, the junior clerk, and Albert. Only Albert and Mr. Elder had rooms to themselves. Mr. Elder's was a large room with a window overlooking the street. Albert's was a curtained-off alcove on the landing and formed an extension to a sort of miniature kitchen that had been built into a large cupboard. And here, Albert Figg was king. And proud as a king, anyway. For here he made the tea, every morning at 11 and every afternoon at 3:30. Good, strong tea, made properly with boiling water in an earthenware teapot. Albert prided himself that there wasn't an office in the whole of the British Isles, and that meant the whole world, where the staff had better tea. Big firms might have their canteens or their urns taken round on trolleys, but the staff of Elder and Company had Albert.
I say, Mr. Fig, is tea nearly ready?
It was a 16-year-old copytypist there called Podge.
Oh, good morning, Miss Jones. Nearly ready. Just give it time to brew, you know.
Albert had a soft corner for Miss Jones. For one thing, she was the only one who called him Mr. Fig, which was only right, considering her age. But she hadn't had to be told. In return, he always addressed her as Miss Jones, instead of Podge. And despite the air of formality that always surrounded their conversations, they were the best of friends.
"Oh, don't you keep it lovely in here," she said. "Honest, Mr. Fig, it's like a little palace. Everything shines so, and so neat. Wish I could learn to be tidy like you."
"Well, maybe when you're my age you will be," said Albert. "Many's the turning I got as a boy for leaving things untidy. Could never see the reason for it in those days. Now don't you eat that sugar. Have one of these doughnuts if you're peckish."
"Ooh, you sure you can spare it, Mr. Fig?"
"Ah, go on, take it. Growing girl like you needs it more than me."
Albert always bought something extra with his own money, pretending it was for himself, because he knew the girl never got up early enough to have a proper breakfast. Doughnuts weren't as good for her as bacon and eggs, or a kipper perhaps, but they were better than nothing. And it pleased him to have someone to spoil. Mary, his daughter-in-law, always stopped him from buying anything for his grandsons.
"Mr. Fig, is it today your daughter-in-law's having her party?"
"Oh, so it is. Quite slipped my mind. Oh, bother."
"What's it in aid of, Mr. Fig?"
"Well, not in aid of anything as far as I know, Miss Jones. It's just some sort of woman's group she belongs to. They go round to each other's house in turn for tea and cakes, you know. And a lot of tittle-tattle about other people, more than likely."
"Well, if they're having tea, they ought to have you there to make it, Mr. Fig. Oh, you do make marvellous tea."
"Mary doesn't appreciate a good cup of tea," said Albert. "That's one of the reasons why I took this job on, you know. When you're living in someone else's house, you can't brew up just when you like."
"You know, you ought to get married again, Mr. Fig, and have a home of your own. Then I could come and be your lodger."
"Marry again? Oh, not me, child. I'm too set in my ways to bother with women. And as for being my lodger, what would your mother have to say, eh? Now, come on, out of my way. It's time I took the tea round."
Until Miss Jones reminded him, Mary's hen party had slipped Albert's mind. Now his day was completely spoiled, because he kept thinking about what his daughter-in-law had said a few days before. "Now listen, Dad, there's something I want you to remember. I'm hoping they'll all have gone long before you get back from work. In fact, it mightn't be a bad idea if you took your time. Had a little walk along the front, say, instead of coming straight home. But if any of them are still here, I want you to promise not to say anything about your job. Now, promise."
"There's nothing to be ashamed of in making tea, Mary."
"No, Dad, no, of course not. But I'd rather you didn't mention it all the same. I've told them that you help out in a sort of advisory capacity. Well, after all, it's not as though you have to work, Dad. Ron and I wouldn't take a penny of your pension if you didn't make such a fuss about it." The more Albert thought about what Mary had said, the more annoyed he got. He was proud of doing a job of work at his age, even if it was only making tea. If you did a job well and put your heart into it, you had nothing to be ashamed of. So why should anyone else be ashamed for you? Advisory capacity, indeed. Deceit was something he couldn't abide. He always got caught out in the end anyway. His son Ron ought to put his foot down, but he didn't. And in his own way, he was just as bad as Mary for trying to make out he was something he wasn't. When 4:30 came and it was time for him to go home, he was tired and irritable. He took one last look round his curtained alcove before leaving. A voice came from behind him. It was Miss Jones again.
"Well, Mr. Fig, are you still here?"
"Well, can't you see I am?" "Oh, I'm sorry, Miss Jones. I'm a bit on edge."
"Oh, that's all right, Mr. Fig. I don't blame you. I just brought you this to put in your buttonhole."
It was a yellow rose from the vase on Miss Jones's desk.
"There,"
she said. "Now you'll have all the old girls falling for you, so you behave yourself, Mr. Fig."
No one heard him turn his key in the lock and open the front door. There was too much chatter coming from the sitting room for that. Chatter that died away the moment he put his head round the door. "Afternoon, ladies," Albert said.
Oh, hello, father,
said Mary.
Ladies, this is Ronald's father who lives with us. I'm so glad you could get home in time to meet everyone, father.
Mary smiled as though she meant it, but Albert had glimpsed the momentary alarm on her face when she first caught sight of him. His indignation grew. Ashamed of him, was she? Frightened that he'd give her away? All right, he'd keep her in suspense. Obediently, he went round the room, shaking hands with each of the women in turn. He finished his circuit, ending up by a woman in a blue dress and a hat to match, who said, Mary's told us all about you, Mr. Fig.
Oh, yes. And what has she said?
Mary broke in again.
I told them how much your firm relies on you for advice, father.
Oh, true enough, said Albert. I reckon they couldn't get through the day without me.
He looked hard at Mary. He saw her bite her lip, recognizing his mood of defiance.
Oh, yes, he said. I stir things up quite a bit. Wouldn't you say so, Mary? I keep the pot boiling, eh?
Yes, I'm sure you do, father.
Mary picked up a plateful of cakes and began to walk round the room with it.
Then, of course, there's times when I help to sweeten things a little. But, you know, I enjoy it. It's just my cup of tea, in a manner of speaking.
The sticky cake he was balancing on a plate wobbled as he shook with suppressed laughter. The woman in the blue dress and hat was speaking.
What a charming girl your daughter-in-law is, Mr. Fig, and so proud of you.
It must be nice to have a family that really wants you. Now my son's got on in the world, I never see him.
Has its drawbacks, though. Can't always do what you want, you know.
Well, who can, said the woman.
You know, Mr. Fig, it's a funny thing. I keep thinking that we've met somewhere, quite recently. Wonder where it was. I live right over the other side of town. Perhaps I've seen you going into your office.
She wrinkled her forehead as she thought it over. There she did so, Albert recognized her as the woman who'd been in the cash desk in the Serve Yourself shop that very morning. He was about to tell her so when Mary interrupted them.
Father, would you care for another cup of tea?
Her face was pale. Her eyes pleaded. In that moment, Albert saw clearly how much her little world meant to her, how pathetically important it was to her to be able to believe that in getting away from the shabby London street where she was born, she'd taken a step up in the world. And yet, for all that, she'd welcomed him into her house. She'd given her home to an irritable old man who'd been scheming to spoil it all for her.
Well, of course she was a silly girl, but she wasn't unkind.
Albert went out to work because he wanted to. The woman in the blue hat went because she had to, because her son had forgotten her. It could only be a matter of moments before the woman in the blue hat remembered where she'd seen him and blurted it out in front of everyone. Then it wouldn't be many more moments before someone put two and two together and realized that an elderly man working in an advisory capacity didn't go out to buy the tea and biscuits. As anxious now to keep Mary's secret as he had been to give it away, he could think of only one thing to do. He must get the woman in the blue hat by herself and explain.
No, Mary dear, I won't have any more tea, he said. I was just thinking that if this lady lives at the other side of town, she might be glad of an escort home, and perhaps we might take a stroll on the pier.
Mary's look of relief was reward enough. All the same, as Albert held the door open for the woman in the blue hat, he was thinking,
well, you've done it now, Albert Fig, you silly old fool. Taking out a woman you've only just met.
But as the woman in the blue hat took his arm and smiled up at him, The same nice smile he'd noticed in the service elf shop. Albert straightened his shoulders and lifted his face to feel the warmth of the last rays of the sun. Maybe, just maybe, it wouldn't be so bad after all to have a lady friend to go out with now and then. He glanced down at the yellow rose little Miss Jones had put in his buttonhole and gave it a friendly wink. Yes, a flower in your buttonhole and a girl on your arm. It felt rather nice after all these years.
That story, Albert Stirs Things Up, was told by Anthony Bilbo. He'll be back tomorrow to read the last of these five stories written by him and Marjorie Bilbo, tomorrow's story being called Worthington's Dog Day.
It's 11 o'clock and time for another morning story with...
A good trip, matey. I'll swear they were both laughing at me. Well, how did they know the great Aunt Josephine wasn't coming back? Or didn't they? Difficult to tell, isn't it?
That story, Worthington and Gladstone Change Trains, was told by Anthony Bilbo.
It's 11 o'clock. Here is Morning Story with Anthony Bilbo.
Hello again. Today's story is called The Same Old Story. I wonder if you remember a friend of mine called Gregory. You know, the one who was always inventing things. I haven't told you anything about him for some time because, well, to be frank, I didn't know where he was or what he was doing. Then about 3 months ago, I ran into him by chance outside a cinema near Piccadilly. They were showing one of those monster from outer space things, and there was a coloured poster the size of a double-fronted house stuck on the wall outside, showing this creature, a sort of giant with two heads, battling with a tiny figure in what I suppose was the film director's idea of what the well-dressed man of 2060 will be wearing, a short green tunic with a belt. This poster caught my eye. Well, you could hardly miss it. And I stopped to look at the photographs outside. As I worked my way along, I bumped into someone coming away from the pay box. And as I turned to apologize, I found it was Gregory. We made all the usual well-fancy-meeting-you noises, and I asked him if he was going in to see the film. I think he was about to say no, when he realized he was still clutching his ticket. So he put on one of his superior expressions and said, Well, yes, I find it rather amusing to see how many scientific errors I can pick out. Yes, I expect you do, I said. But I'm no scientist and I like to swallow it whole, at the time, anyway. If you don't mind, I'll join you, Gregory, but don't you dare point out any scientific errors until it's over. Well, it was a marvellous film. The giant with two heads terrorised the world, carrying off treasures and whole herds of cows and dozens of beautiful girls and taking them all back to its home in the stratosphere. Nobody was able to do anything about it until the hero, the chap in the green tunic, came along. Completely unscientific, of course, but tremendous fun. I stole a look at Gregory, and he was as absorbed as anyone in the audience, which didn't really surprise me because although Gregory puts on such airs, he's a very human person, really. When the lights went up at the end, I turned to him and said, "Well?" He adjusted his superior expression again and said, "Oh, ridiculous nonsense, quite impossible. One thing, the pressure in the stratosphere on a creature of that size would..." "Gregory," I said, "admit that you enjoyed it." "Oh, well, all right then, yes, every minute of it," he said. Over a meal in the cinema restaurant afterwards, I told him something of what I'd been doing since we last met, and asked him what he'd been up to. He looked very mysterious and said, "Shh." "What do you mean, shh?" I said. "There's nobody in the restaurant but us, unless you count that waitress over by the door, and if you think she's taking any notice, just you try asking for another jug of hot water." Anyway, I'm not asking you to reveal any official secrets. I probably wouldn't understand the jargon if you did. Gregory looked round him carefully, peered under the table, lifted the vase of flowers and shook it, spilling water in the sugar bowl. And then he said, I've got a job at Little Twiddlecombe on the Moors. Very hush-hush. What, I said? Not at the new government atomic research station. Gregory nearly shot through the ceiling before saying, shh, for the second time, and adding that you never knew who might be listening. Well, I said, if anybody is listening, it's not going to do him much good, is it? Everybody knows where the new research station is. There were big pictures of it in all the papers a few months ago, and I saw a whole half-hour television feature devoted to it. I don't expect you to tell me what you're doing there. Well, as a matter of fact, said Gregory, I'm not doing very much at all at the moment. I was working on a device for detecting the detecting device that detected our original detecting device. You probably read about that too. And it was all scrapped because we found that the other people had already developed a new device for detecting this one. And in any case, it was out of date because we ourselves had developed another device for detecting their one. Stop! You're making me dizzy, I said. Look, let's go back to the bit where you said you aren't doing very much at the moment. Are you on holiday? Well, sort of extended leave. I'd been doing a few private experiments of my own that went wrong. And the old man said I needed a break anyway. So I'm off duty for a few weeks. I didn't inquire into the private experiments that had gone wrong. Gregory's inventions, though often brilliant, have a way of getting him into hot water. So I let the conversation drift into the harmless channels of what books we'd read and what films and plays we'd seen since last we met. I was quite surprised when later on he brought the subject up again himself. By the way, Tony, what do you think these are? Gregory took from his pocket a small leather drawstring bag and poured into my hand five small blackish objects. Oh, they look rather like coffee beans to me, I said. You're not so far out, said Gregory. For some time I've been carrying out a number of tests, subjecting various seeds to atomic ray bombardment and so on, with quite fascinating results. What sort of results, I asked. Well, to be quite honest, Tony, I'm not sure. It's all rather contradictory. And anyway, there hasn't been time for all the evidence to be sifted and collated. You see, after the seeds have been treated, they have to be planted. And then when they grow, or indeed if they grow, they have to be watched and notes made of their progress. I planted some in Little Twiddlecombe, but conditions weren't exactly right. I was wondering, would you like to try these for me? Now, I'm very wary of getting mixed up in Gregory's experiments. I've had some. But curiosity is a strong master, so I said, what would I have to do then? Oh, just plant one a week and make notes of their rates of growth. Quite simple, really. But I haven't got a garden, I said. Not of my own, anyway. Oh, flower pots will do, said Gregory. Fairly big ones, of course. I don't know what it is about, Gregory. Just when you're telling yourself firmly that you aren't going to do anything of the sort, you find yourself saying, all right, I'm sure it'll be very interesting. Thanks for the opportunity, Gregory. You see, not only doing what he wants, but actually thanking him for letting you do it. And I even went and bought five flower pots, paying for them out of my own money. Gregory gave me careful instructions about putting bits of broken brick at the bottom of the flower pots to help them drain, told me how much earth to put in, and how to stand each one in the sink in water for a certain length of time before putting in the bean. All quite simple in one sense, but remarkably difficult when you have to scrounge about on building sites to find bits of brick and dig up somebody else's garden to get soil. However, my interest sustained me for the planting of the first bean in the first pot, and I watered it every day and peered closely for signs of growth every morning when I woke. The start of the second week arrived, and with less enthusiasm than before, I prepared the second pot and planted the second bean. Still nothing happened. As the weeks came and went, I planted the third and fourth and fifth beans, and I looked gloomily at the five pots lined up on my sitting room windowsill, and thought how much more attractive a few indoor ivy plants would have been. Then, to my joy, four of them began to grow. Once they started, they grew very fast, but in miniature, and they produced perfect little bean plants, flowered, fruited, and died, all within the space of a few days. I made careful notes, measured the plants with calipers every 12 hours, and then I wrote out a full report which I sent to Gregory by registered post. He sent me a card, making no mention at all of his experiments with seeds, but saying that he was working on something revolutionary connected with a new man-made fibre, and would I be interested in trying out a shirt that never needed washing? I dropped the card in my waste paper basket and looked at the five pots still lined up on my sitting room windowsill, furious with myself for having given in to Gregory in the first place. Then I flung open the window and tossed them one after another to the bottom of the garden, where they burst open and scattered soil and bits of brick over the compost heap. "There," I said, "and that is positively the last time I get mixed up with any of Gregory's tomfoolery." The funny thing was that the fifth bean started to grow. And next evening, when I looked out of my window, I could see a couple of leaves showing green against the little heap of earth that had been the contents of the flower pot. I woke extra early next morning and lay in bed, watching the pattern made on the ceiling by the shadows thrown by the branches of the tree outside. Then it came to me that there was no tree outside. I flung back the bedclothes and ran to the window. I looked out. Then I laughed. "Huh, what a silly dream," I said. "The alarm clock will go off in a few moments and you'll wake up." And then the alarm clock did go off, and I was still awake. And I was looking out of the window at the biggest tree I'd ever seen, stretching up and up and up, further than I could see even when I leaned out of the window and craned my neck towards the sky. I pulled on some clothes and ran out into the garden. I had a pretty good idea what had happened. More than likely the same thing had happened in Little Twiddlecombe-on-the-Moors before Gregory had been sent off on extended leave by his boss, and I meant to hide all traces of it being my fault before anyone else woke up and came out to have a look. I took a hasty glance round at all the windows overlooking the garden. Nobody seemed to be stirring. Then I picked up the broken flower pots and carried them to the dustbin. Then I borrowed a rake from the shed and levelled the heaps of soil where the flower pots had broken open, where I threw them. Then I put the rake away when I'd found it and stood back to see whether I'd covered my tracks successfully. I had, and I was now prepared to be as amazed as any other innocent party and to wonder as loudly as the best of them how on earth such a thing could have grown up in a single night. And then, it was a silly thing to do. I might have broken my neck and it would have served me right. Then I looked up at the trunk of it and noticed how conveniently the branches were placed. You know, there's something about climbing trees. I loved it when I was a small boy, and I suppose I've never really stopped loving it. What usually happens is, of course, that unless you've the head for heights of a steeplejack, you go on quite happily until something makes you look down, and then it seems a very, very long way to the ground. I should think I must have been a couple of hundred feet up when I looked down. I turned quite dizzy and clung tightly to the nearest branch. Suddenly, I became aware of a rustling noise above me. And if I hadn't been holding on so tightly, I'm sure I'd have fallen like a stone when a voice said, "I say, old boy, back down, will you? I'll never be able to pass you." I peered up, but leaves and branches obscured my view, and all I could see were a pair of feet in soft leather sandals with brown ankles above them. The voice came again. "Come on, buck up, I'm in a deuce of a hurry." "Well, just take it easy," I said. "It's much harder going down. You can't see where you're putting your feet. And it's a nasty long drop to the ground from here." "Oh, nothing to what it is from where I've been," the voice retorted. "Here, grab this for a minute. It'll give me a free hand while I pass you, and then I'll help you find your footholds." "What on earth are you doing up here with a harp?" I said, as I took the object he was passing down to me. "Oh, for goodness sake, I haven't time to explain all that now." And the man slithered down rapidly on the far side of the trunk, grabbed hold of my left foot, and pushed it into the crotch of a lower branch. "Right," he said. Now hand me back the harp, and then come on down as fast as you can. And hurry, man, hurry. Once I started, the descent was fairly easy. Anyway, I wasn't going to be put to shame by the stranger, who was dropping neatly from branch to branch with an effortless unconcern, pausing only to call to me to hurry. As I reached the ground at last, I turned and had a proper look at him for the first time. He was quite young, and he was wearing a short green tunic with a belt that seemed somehow familiar. I say, he said, you haven't got such a thing as an axe, have you? Well, there ought to be one in that shed over there, I think, I said. Seconds later, he was hacking away at the trunk of my tree as hard as he could. Hey, steady on, I said. What do you think you're doing? Oh, no time to talk now, he said, swinging away. Give me a couple of minutes and I'll be with you. A very interesting story, as a matter of fact. The tree gave a shudder. A sighing sound came from its branches, and it toppled and fell across the garden and into the field at the back. The man in green turned to me with a satisfied smile on his face. Well, I must say, I said, I think that's a bit thick. What do you mean by destroying my property like that? It's part of a scientific experiment, let me tell you. I say, old boy. Do you mean to say it was yours? Well, of course it was mine, I said. Who did you think it was? I say, old boy, I'm most frightfully sorry, he said. I've obviously made the most ghastly bloomer. Must have come down the wrong beanstalk. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this week of stories. I'll be back with another 5 in September. So until then, goodbye, and thank you for listening.
Morning Story, every day this week, will be told by Anthony Bilbo.
Good morning. It's nice to be back, and I hope you'll join me every morning this week. Today's story is called Worthington Goes to the Circus. My dog Worthington and I snatched an early holiday this year. We hope to get away later on in the summer too, which gives us something to look forward to, but I don't think we could possibly have a better time than we did in May. Of course, normally I can't afford to go away more than once, but this was a special treat. A friend of mine bought a small caravan and arranged to have it parked for the summer on a site down on the south coast. But after making all the arrangements, he found he couldn't get away, so he asked me if I'd mind running it down for him. He knew I had a week's holiday coming up, and he said that if I liked to hire a car and didn't mind hitching his caravan on behind, he'd go halves with all the expenses. Well, between you, me and Worthington, I'd already toyed with the idea of hiring a car and touring the southern counties. So I said, done, and bought Worthington a new brush and comb on the strength of it. Worthington has always enjoyed riding in cars, but now his pleasure was doubled. Whenever he got tired of riding beside me on the front seat and expressing his candid opinion of jaywalkers and careless drivers, he could rise at his ease on the foam-pillowed bunk in the caravan, watching the road behind, putting out his tongue at all the traffic we passed, and jeering at other dogs forced to travel on foot. But when night came, and I said it was time for bed, it was quite a different story. He didn't take kindly to sleeping in the caravan, and probably he missed his chair. I did my best for him. I put a rug and a folded blanket on the floor, and pointed out that it made an excellent bed with lots of room to stretch. He blew down his nose derisively and watched me as I got into my own bunk and turned out the light. Then he began to walk up and down, rattling his toenails on the linoleum and grumbling to himself in a monotonous sound somewhere between a whistle and a growl. I refused to feel sorry for him. I'd made a perfectly good bed for him, taking care that it was out of the draught, and I wasn't going to pander to him by letting down the second bunk for him. I just said, "Shh," pulled the blankets round my ears to shut out the noise of his fidgeting, and was soon asleep. I dreamed that I was sitting on the bank of a river, fishing, and the Loch Ness Monster swam up and grabbed me by the feet. I kicked out in panic, and Worthington, who'd been lying across my ankles, woke us both by falling to the floor with a thud. I sat up in bed and rubbed my feet to get rid of an acute attack of pins and needles. Serves you right, I said. I didn't kick you on purpose, but I'm not sorry. Now go to sleep. Worthington made no reply. He just stood there, biding his time. And as I stopped rubbing my feet and went to lie down again, he took a great bound and landed on my chest, knocking all the breath out of me. As I gasped for air, he flung himself down with his back to me and began to push with all the strength of his four powerful legs. And inch by inch, he moved me nearer and nearer to the edge of the bunk. I defy anyone in a similar situation to prevent a large, determined dog from pushing him out of bed. I ended up sitting on the floor, while Worthington stiffened his limbs to avoid being lifted off, and rolled his eyes so far around in an attempt to watch me through the back of his head that the whites of them glittered eerily in the moonlight. All right, you win, I said. I suppose if either of us is to get any sleep at all tonight, I might as well give you your own way now rather than later. And I let down the second bunk and put Worthington's blanket onto it. When morning came, and we woke to the sound of birds singing, cows mooing, pigs squealing, and housewife's choice on the radio in a farmhouse kitchen, he bounced about on his bunk and looked out of the window and gave me to understand that he wouldn't mind living like this forever and ever. We'd been driving for about 3 hours, after a satisfying breakfast of sausages and bacon, when Worthington, who had been sitting peacefully on the back seat of the car, began to get restless. He stood up on his back legs, directed his nose towards the open window, and began to sniff. Not loudly, but rather as a connoisseur sips at a glass of wine before venturing an opinion on its quality. His nostrils quivered with interest, and then he began to wag his tail and wiggle his ears. Well, I didn't notice anything, but as G.K. Chesterton once pointed out, we haven't got no noses. So I stopped the car and put my head out. At first, nothing. Then, very faint and far away, I heard a sound that took me right back to childhood. A fair, Worthington, I said. I'm sure that's what it is. Let's try and find it. He climbed over into the front seat, and between us we tracked it down. Little by little, the tinny music became louder, and Worthington sniffing more and more ecstatic, until we turned a corner between high hedges, and 100 yards down the lane came to a 5-barred gate opening onto a field. There we found not a fair, but a small travelling circus. It didn't seem to be doing much business, although the music went on bravely. There were about 12 small boys and 4 or 5 small girls hanging around outside a big round tent, as though longing to go in, but not wanting to be the first. And as Worthington and I stepped out of the car and stood by the gate, a man dressed in ringmaster's clothes called out to me that I would miss the show of a lifetime if I didn't come in. I walked over to him, with Worthington trotting at my heels, and said I should like to see the show very much indeed, but was afraid that the lions and tigers wouldn't like my dog. The man grinned. Oh, bless your heart, there's no lions and tigers here. Nothing dangerous at all, barring my missus. I never did go in for that sort of thing. Leave it to the big boys that can afford to look after them properly. Have you got any idea what it costs to feed just one lion, let alone 6 or so? No, this is a real old-fashioned family circus. One daughter does the flying trapeze, another is the bareback rider, my sons are clowns, my nephew's the wire walker. I'm the ringmaster, and my wife takes the tickets and sells the programs. Of course, we don't make much money. The business has been in the family for 100 years and more. And so long as I can hold it together, I'm carrying on. Well, good for you, I said. Now, as regards your dog, take him in with you if you like. Just keep your eye on him and stop him jumping into the ring. And so I bought 2 tickets. It seemed only fair. And went in. This seemed to make up the minds of the children hanging about outside. And I felt like the Pied Piper of Hamelin as we all trooped in. When I looked around, I found that the audience was mostly children, with a sprinkling of adults. But there were great gaps in the tiers of seats, and the overall effect was of a mouth with a few teeth set in it. To anyone used to the big circuses that come to London at Christmas, this one was very tame. But it had a freshness and simplicity that was somehow very touching. There were six performers altogether, and they took it in turns to go off and come back in a different costume to be announced by the ringmaster under a different name. A sturdy pony trotted amiably round the ring, wearing a tinsel star on its forehead, with the bareback rider standing on her head. Her own head, not the pony's. Before returning, quite unconcerned, without the tinsel star, as Black Bess in Turpin's Ride to York. Well, I enjoyed every minute of it, but Worthington began to doze off to sleep, until the performing seal came on. Sammy the Super Seal was how they announced him, and he was the only member of the circus who didn't play more than one part. Worthington was delighted with Sammy and barked an excited response to his "Ooh, ooh." I told him to be quiet, otherwise I'd have to take him outside, and after that he sat in silence, feasting his eyes on the antics of this strange kind of black dog with flat feet that balanced plates on its nose and swallowed fish whole. Sammy was the undoubted star of the show, a thoroughly polished performer with tremendous stage presence, and, naturally, he topped the bill. Immediately his act was over, we had the parade of all nations with the same six members of the circus family in tights and carrying flags, and then it was all over. Worthington and I wandered round the field afterwards until we found the caravan where Sammy lived in a collapsible bath. On hearing Worthington's excited bark, Sammy leaned out of the window and clapped his flippers together energetically, remarking, "Oof, oof." "They've taken quite a fancy to each other, haven't they?" The circus owner had come up behind me. "I suppose you wouldn't consider selling your dog. They make a wonderful double act." No, I said, "he's not for sale." "No, I didn't think he would be, but it was worth asking. Did you enjoy the show?" "Oh, very much indeed," I said. "I think you're a very talented family." "I'm sorry for such a small audience, though. Are you here for the week?" The man shook his head. He explained that they were on their way to a more profitable site near the coast, playing one-night stands as they went, in the hope of covering expenses. He didn't go into details, but I gathered things weren't going too well. It was difficult to drag ourselves away from Sammy, but we couldn't afford to lose any more time. Worthington hung back reluctantly as I walked towards the gate, and I called back to him, "All right, then I'll go without you," knowing that he'd come running as soon as he heard me start the engine. I found a grimy small boy sitting on the grimy bonnet of my car, finishing off the sentence, "Dirty, go and wash it," which he was tracing with his finger in the dust. He wasn't in the least put out by my return, and it took me a few minutes to chase him off and make sure that he wasn't underneath the wheels. When at last I pressed the starter, Worthington was in his seat beside me. I drove on steadily for some 50 or 60 miles, until, seeing a sign advertising farmhouse teas, I remembered that it was a long time since breakfast. I pulled into the side, and Worthington and I walked down the garden path of a house set well back from the road. I called out to a girl wearing a flowered apron.
"Is it all right if I bring my dog in?"
"Oh, certainly," she said. "Would he like a drink of water?" "Oh, that's very kind of you," I said. "But I think we'd rather have tea. I'll have a pot for two, if you'll be good enough to bring me an empty bowl or an old saucer for him." I felt pleasantly relaxed as I sipped my tea and ate my sixth freshly baked scone with real jam. The girl came over to my table and admired Worthington. "He's very well behaved," she said. "Is the other one troublesome, then?" "What other one?" "The dog you left in your car, the black one." "But I haven't got another dog," I said. She looked at me as though I was mad. "But I heard him barking just now, and when I looked down the path, I could see his head at the window of your car. There, he's barking again."
"Oh, oh."
I hope I paid my bill. I honestly can't remember anything from that moment until the one when I reached the car and peered in, hoping desperately that I'd been mistaken. No such luck. Sammy's bright, friendly eyes met mine, and as I opened the door, he flopped out onto the grass verge and engaged in a good-tempered bit of catch-as-catch-can with Worthington. "I suppose this is your doing," I said. "I wish you'd use some sense, Worthington. I might have been arrested for stealing him. Back into the car with you both. Come on, come on, Sammy. Alley-oop!" The circus owner was overjoyed to get his seal back unhurt.
I couldn't think what had happened to him, he said. I was afraid he'd stray down into the woods and might get hurt in the trap. Sammy, you bad boy. I've never known him do a thing like that before. Well, I expect it's as much my dog's fault, I said. The circus owner nodded and smiled. It's funny how they've taken a liking to each other. I wish you was travelling with us so that they could play together now and then. The exercise would be good for Sammy. Well, I said cautiously, of course we are going in much the same direction. I don't see why we shouldn't take our time from yours for a day or two. I never thought, when I began my week's holiday, that I should be selling programs at a small travelling circus, or calling to passers-by to walk up, walk up. Or that on one unforgettable night, I should be allowed to paint my face, dress up as a clown, and fool about in the ring. It was fulfilling a childhood ambition. Actually, Wellington came to the ring too, and caused great amusement to the children by sitting down and doing exactly the opposite to whatever I told him to do. He's a bit of a show-off sometimes, and he didn't mean me to get all the biggest laughs. And now, it's all over, and we're home again. Our exciting week under the big top is just a memory, except for a glossy photograph of Sammy the Super Seal propped up against the telephone. Oh, yes, and except for one or two rather tiresome habits that Worthington has picked up. I don't mind him flapping his front paws together and barking like Sammy, or balancing his rubber ball on his nose. And I don't really mind his passion for eating raw fish, because I know he hates it really and will soon give it up. What I do object to is the fact that he expects me to throw all his food to him so that he can catch it in his mouth. It's so distracting when I'm trying to paint my nose red.
Worthington Goes to the Circus was the first of five stories by Anthony Bilbo. He'll be back tomorrow with one called The Boy. Oh, and by the way, you can hear Anthony and Marjorie Bilbo in a quarter of an hour in the Home Service in It Was Fun to Do. It's a repeat of some of their interviews for In Town Tonight.